This is Night Call, the new nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tonight's subject, American violence and black anti-Semitism. Tonight's guest, Morris Abrams, president of the American Jewish Committee and president-designate of Brandeis University. You speak for yourself and ask your questions directly by calling Collect, Night Call's national phone number, area code 212-749-3311, or in the New York area, 866-5010. Night Call's host in New York City is Del Shields.
Good evening. I don't know if anybody ever listens to credits on radio or reads them on television. I suspect not. They are there mostly for the record. Since Monday night of this week, we have an added starter in the Night Call credits at the end of the show. It is the American Jewish Committee. We have thought since we first went on the air 2 months ago that we should broaden our religious base, the National Council of Churches and National Catholic Office of Radio and Television, to include the third great American religion. And when the AJC expressed interest, we were only too delighted to welcome them aboard. In the official announcement of our new affiliation, our boss, Dr. Harry Spencer, the General Secretary of the Television, Radio, and Film Commission of the United Methodist Church, put it this way, and we quote, "Over the centuries, the Jewish people have experienced the handicap of being a minority. Nevertheless, historically, they have emphasized the intellectual understanding of diverse points of view, and as a result, they have become a part of the culture and society in which they live. They have not withdrawn, but rather have worked through the established educational, economic, and political structures to create a more just society for all people. We look forward to working with the American Jewish Committee on the presentation of Night Call," unquote. We'll leave it up to tonight's guest to explain just what the AJC is all about. He's rather expert on the subject. 4 years ago, at the age of 46, Morris Abram became the youngest president in the history of the American Jewish Committee, a position and a distinction he continues to hold at age 50. In September, Mr. Abram will also take over as the new president of Brandeis University, which incidentally is the location of the Lindbergh Center for the Study of Violence, the only center of its kind in the country. He's also senior advisor to the United States Mission to the United Nations, the U.S. representative to the U.N. Commission on Human Rights, and a member of President Johnson's National Advisory Council on Economic Opportunity. He is a native of Georgia, a graduate of the University of Georgia Law School, and a Rhodes Scholar. His chief legal claim to fame was his successful Supreme Court battle to have the Georgia County Unit System declared unconstitutional. Mr. Abram knows about violence. He was a member of the prosecution staff at the Nuremberg War Crimes Trials after World War II. And he knows about anti-Semitism, black and white, Nazi and Russian. He helped focus attention on the current wave of Soviet anti-Semitism. Mr. Abram is standing by in New York to answer your questions and share your comments and conversation about American violence and black anti-Semitism. You may speak to him direct at our national phone number, which is area code 212-749-3311. And, of course, you're always welcome to call us collect. That's national calls on area code 212-749-3311. In the New York area, you may call us at 866-5010. That's 866-5010. Mr. Abram, good evening, sir.
Good evening, Mr. Shields.
And thank you so much for being with us.
Delighted to be here.
Could you begin first by telling us a little of just what the American Jewish Committee is and what is its purpose?
Well, the American Jewish Committee is the oldest human rights or human relations organization in the world. It was founded in 1906. To protest the disgraceful murder and deprivation of rights of Jews in Russia in the Kishinev pogrom. It was founded originally to protect the rights of Jews, but very soon it became clear that you can't protect the rights of any one group. You must protect the rights of all if the rights of any are to be held sacred. So since the early days of its foundation, the committee has been engaged in the protection of the rights of all people, not only here, but abroad.
Mr. Abram, to set the stage for tonight's advertised subject, American violence and black anti-Semitism, I'd like to first quote from a piece that Irving Spiegel of the New York Times wrote about a month ago. And recording from the article, The American Jewish community, is confused and troubled over its relationships with black people. A strain of ambivalence has crept into its long-time kinship and support for the black cause. It is perhaps even more uncertain in the wake of recent urban riots about black attitudes toward Jews. There is some Jewish backlash whipped up by the slum explosions in which many Jewish merchants, generally small businessmen, were looted and burned out. There is Jewish resentment over the anti-Israeli stance of black extremists who accuse the Jewish state of Zionist imperialism and oppressions against the Arabs. And there is Jewish bewilderment over the step-aside whitey thrust of black militants whose do-it-alone nationalism derides former black partnerships with white groups among whom Jewish organizations were highly visible. Unquote. That was Irving Spiegel writing in the New York Times.
Yes.
Mr. Abram, just how justified is black anti-Semitism?
Well, black anti-Semitism, like white anti-Semitism, isn't justified at all. I think it's outrageous for any people, white or black, to draw the line and draw the bead on and to hate and to take overt discriminatory action by word or deed against another people because of their race, color, or religion. So I say it's unjustified and totally so, just as white racism is unjustified.
How widespread is the Jewish backlash?
Well, I suspect that there is a Jewish backlash. I've seen some of it. I'm bound to say that. I say it in sorrow. But I would put it in focus. I don't know of any Jews who've joined the Ku Klux Klan since the development of some strains in the white and the Negro community as a result of the Negroes' push towards more equality quicker. And as a result, I suppose also, one must say candidly and frankly, of some of the riots and demonstrations that have occurred in the country. There is some Jewish backlash, but I would say it's not intense, and I would say it's not pervasive, and I would say this for sure, and that is every responsible Jewish leader in this country fights against it. And I know none who condone it, absolutely none. Now, there are leaders in so-called leaders in the Negro community who have not exercised leadership over some of the militants who say some very nonsensical things. But I would say that most Negro leaders have been very responsible and have fought black anti-Semitism. But every Jewish leader fights racism and the backlash.
In many of the black communities, the question is raised about exploitation of the black people by the Jewish merchants. How do you account for that?
Well, I think, first of all, most people who are poor feel that their lives are exploited almost every day. And I suppose that if I lived in a ghetto community, as so many of our Negro fellow citizens do, I would feel that I was a victim of exploitation in my schools and in practically everything I do. Now, inasmuch as it is true that a large number of the merchants are in the ghetto, the natural target of this feeling is that merchant. And as he happens in many cases to be Jewish, the target is a Jewish man. However, I would suspect that there is no deliberate exploitation as much as there is just the circumstance that the Negro in the ghetto does live an impoverished life, has less to spend, probably buys in smaller quantities, and for a variety of reasons, I suppose he doesn't get the advantages that the better off people in society get who purchase in the supermarkets, the big stores, and the places where credit is not required and where the service is better.
There is another question that is sometimes raised, and I think it is raised more behind the scenes rather than publicly, but among black people there is a feeling of resentment in what they call or directed towards what is generally called the paternalistic attitude on the part of the black, or I should say on the part of the Jewish merchant in his relationships with the black people?
Well, I think paternalism towards black people has been a part of the so-called better white tradition in this country. Not that I condone it, but you were referring to my age, Mr. Shields. I can remember the time when paternalism was so much better than that kind of white outrage and outrageous white conduct which found its outlet in violence, that paternalism was something that people thought was the better of several evils. Now, of course, it's not the proper relationship between people. And it is true that I'm sure there is a lot of paternalism left in all of us. We, all of us, have a hard time wiping out the traditions of years, the bad customs, the bad habits. But it's certainly to be avoided, and I suppose that that most white people, unless they're very careful, do fall victim to their own errors. But again, I would say the Jewish community tries, as a whole, very, very hard to live up to the principles of the prophetic tradition, which do not admit of any kind of racism, or indeed any kind of human-to-human relationship less than equality, and paternalism is not a relationship of equality, obviously.
You're about to take over as the president of Brandeis University. The enrollment policies at Brandeis, are they any more liberal than most universities in terms of black enrollment?
Well, Brandeis has made some massive efforts to enroll more black students. For example, yesterday I was with the 70-some-odd young people who are part of the Upward Bound program. In this program, we are taking people this summer who have been educationally deprived and trying to give them massive tutorial care and individual attention, hopefully to get them ready to enter university, Brandeis, or some other university next year. Brandeis next year is going to have a marvelous program consisting of the intake of a considerable number of black students, not into the regular college because they are not qualified for regular admission, but to keep them at Brandeis for a year and to prepare them, hopefully, for admission the following year by giving them college courses without credit. Brandeis is doing, as many other colleges and universities, a great deal to try to salvage this great mass of potential in our young people, mainly black and Puerto Rican, but also including some whites, who have real ability, but whose ability has been squandered in the past and will be squandered now unless we make some special efforts to salvage it. May I tell you a story about what I saw last night?
Yes, you may.
I saw some of these young people put on a play in the David Merrick Theater at Brandeis. Three one-act plays, as a matter of fact. One was by Albee. Plays had great intellectual content. They were artistically performed and perceptively acted by these kids who are supposed to be education deprived. Well, I just wish that I had had some of the emotional insights that they had when I was of the same age. I was really astounded and gratified.
Our subject tonight is American violence and black anti-Semitism, and Mr. Abram is calling in from New York, and we have a number of calls standing by, and we'll depart early for station identification, and then we'll be coming right back to receive calls from our Night Call listeners. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Morris Abram after station identification.
Black is a red-blooded American color. The black showed the color of his blood in places like Vietnam and Korea and every other all-American battleground since the Revolution. Every time his country calls for help, he hears. But we don't seem to hear him when he calls. If black and white would listen with their hearts, they could hear each other. That's what Night Call is all about. It lets people air their views man to man, color to color, live from phones anywhere in the country. A syringe full of junk bites into black and white skin with the same ruining surge, and a black mother cries over her child just like a white one does. The problems are the same, The characters just have different colors. Night Call's person-to-person nationwide radio hookup lets the black and the white tell it like it is.
Speak for yourself. Collect on Night Call. Area code 212-749-3311 or 866-5010 to Morris Abram about American violence and black anti-Semitism. Again, Del Shields.
Mr. Abram, we'll begin taking our first calls of the evening, and our first caller is Mr. Early, significantly. And Mr. Early is calling in from Indianapolis, Indiana. He's hearing Night Call over WTLC-FM. Mr. Early, your question, sir.
I want to know about the backlash, the Jewish backlash. Would it have anything to do against the Negro or with the Negro?
Well, when Mr. Shields asked me about the Jewish backlash, I was referring to that attitude, which is akin to the so-called white backlash, that is, a reaction by whites who happen to be Jews against Negroes because of the situation that has arisen in the last few years. Now, that's what I suppose we mean by Jewish backlash. I would like to say that I don't think that any of it is situational. Ideological. I don't think it comes out of any feeling that the Jew wants to go in a different direction in this country than the Negro. But I do think that when it exists, that is, this Jewish backlash, it is situational. That is, it grows out of the fact that perhaps a merchant has had his store bombed or firebombed, or because some Jewish person who's been very active in the civil rights movement is told by a Negro, we want to go it alone, we don't want you anymore. And that rebuff is very likely to create feeling of anguish and sometimes bitterness. I don't condone it in any case, but that's the fact to which I was referring.
Oh, well, you know, most Negroes, when they firebomb or, you know, however it's called, just violence, It's not, you know, meant towards just white alone. I guess what I've heard from my, you know, friends and neighbors, that they're just fighting for rights.
Of course, I don't think you can fight for rights by violence. And in my judgment, violence is a very dangerous weapon because it can always produce counter-violence. And in my judgment, there are more mean people in this world with poor motives who are disposed to violence than there are people with good motives who are disposed to violence. And I think if you turn your country over to violence, what we'll have is the bad people will prevail and not the good.
Thank you for calling, Mr. Early.
Okay.
Thank you. This is Night Call in New York, and our next Night Call listener, Mr. Briggs, is hearing Night Call over WOSU-FM in Lanchester, Ohio. Your question, Mr. Briggs.
Mr. Abram, are you familiar with an organization named Moral Rearmament Incorporated?
Yes, I've been familiar with it for 30 years.
Is it, to your knowledge, anti-Semitic?
Not to my knowledge, no.
Do you have any further information on it?
No, I've had many friends who were active in the Moral Rearm movement. I know that back in the 30s, there was some feeling among some people that the then head, I don't know whether he still is, of the Moral Rearm movement had visited Hitler, and that's where I think this feeling in cases of some people arose, but I certainly know nothing anti-Semitic in the Moral Rearmament movement.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling. Miss Thomas is hearing Night Call over WLIB-FM right here in New York. She's calling in from Corona, Long Island. Your question, Miss Thomas.
Yes, Mr. Abrams. You spoke before about the hostility and resentment that many black people felt toward Jewish merchants. Well, as a teacher, I've, in the last year, seen a great deal of anti-Jewish sentiment among black people because so many of the teachers in the ghettos are Jewish.
Yes.
And this seems to me to be a serious problem because although these people are, unfortunately, many of them are prejudiced against the black and Puerto Rican children, whereas to a white person, they're simply prejudiced whites, not prejudiced Jews. so often, it seems, to the community, these people are seen as prejudiced Jews.
Yes.
Which makes the whole situation that much more difficult. What is your thinking on this?
Well, I think what the ghetto child needs is a good teacher. And needs a good teacher, whether that teacher is black or Protestant or Catholic or Jewish. And I wish we could focus more on the quality of the teacher rather than on his ethnic or religious background. And that's the first thing I think, and I think you would agree with me. Now, the next thing I think is that while it may well be true that in some schools there are a great many Jewish teachers, it is, in my judgment, un-American and outrageous to rail against this. So long as the teacher is doing a good job, the color and religion ought to be irrelevant. But I suppose that it is a fact that if there is a movement in the Negro community in one place or another to have more black teachers, and while I don't disagree with the purpose, if it would affect the learning process favorably, and if you find that a good many of the teachers whom you would replace happen to be of a certain group, I would urge that sensible people not urge they be replaced because they happen to belong to a certain religion, but that they be replaced only because a black teacher may be may create an improvement in the learning process. You don't have to speak ill of one group of people in order to advance the cause of the employment of someone who may be better qualified to teach a particular child.
Mr. Abrams, do you think that perhaps this is one of the reasons why so many of the teachers themselves oppose desegregation?
Oh, I suppose the law of self-preservation is one of the first laws of nature.
Exactly. In other words, they feel that they're in jeopardy.
Yeah. You know, I can remember very well when a good many of the black teachers in segregated schools were a little worried about desegregation because they were afraid that their jobs would be taken by white teachers. So this happens both ways. It's fear, I suppose, of job stability by white and black, by Jew and Catholic and Protestant.
Well, here in New York City, of course, the issue is decentralization. I wondered, does your organization have an official stand or policy on decentralization in urban schools?
The national organization has never taken a policy on it, but let me give you my own personal view if you want it. And
yes,
that
I'd
is
like
that
it.
As close as a school can be to a community, I think the better off school is, but I would... I believe that responsibility comes when people have power. Now, I would hate very much to see the standards of schools deteriorate because of the desire to have for local control, but I don't really think that standards necessarily will deteriorate if you turn some aspects of school government over to those whose children are being educated.
Thank you very much, Mr. Abrams.
Thank you for calling.
Good night.
This is Night Call in New York, area code 212-749-3311. That's our national telephone number. And, of course, you may feel free always to call us collectively. We welcome your comments as well as your conversation. Tonight, American violence and black anti-Semitism. And our guest calling in from New York tonight, Mr. Morris Abram. Our next caller again from Indianapolis, Indiana, hearing Night Call over WTLC-FM, Mr. Sider. Your question, sir.
Yes, I'd like to ask Mr. Abrams to react to this thought of mine. It's been my thinking recently that the issue of black anti-Semitism, and I'm not denying that this exists to a certain degree, if this isn't really being used as a smokescreen to permit some members of the Jewish community to, in a sense, cop out now when the civil rights or human rights struggle is really getting down to the situation where a personal, some kind of deep personal commitment is required, whether it's to a certain extent a financial sacrifice, since now what's really needed is more than just support for legislation. It's active, an active role is required, such as accepting additional black employees at a plant or fighting for school desegregation where that's feasible, or local control where that's really the only viable alternative, or desegregating housing where this is also still a problem.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I think it is a way, an easy way sometimes, for many people of faint heart and short memory to cop out. I thoroughly agree with you. On the other hand, I think there's another element in it too, and that is the fact that some, and many Jews have, some who've contributed so much to the civil rights cause really feel a little left out when, as so many Negroes now do, they say that they want to go it alone now.
Well, isn't it possible that...
They may be very right, you know, in going it alone in many ways, and I'm not arguing with it, but nevertheless, when a child leaves home, sometimes a parent isn't very mature about it.
Well, this, of course, is true, but even so, even if a certain portion of the black community insists that it wants to go it alone to have control of the civil rights movement or whatever the struggle is called now, if a person feels a deep individual commitment, there are avenues through which he can continue to pursue this. Now, he may not be able to have a leadership position, say, in organizations that were formerly...
But he can sure improve the white community, can't he?
Right, but there's still a great deal of missionary work, I guess,
I agree
often
with you.
Called, that can be done within the Jewish community itself.
Indeed, there can be. You know, one of the things, though, that I would like to pick you up on, I don't find much evidence of Jewish concern and anxiety about the economic burden of really rebuilding this country in a more sane and rational and fair way. That may be true in some communities, but I don't really find that there are a great many Jews, certainly not a predominant number of them, who are worried about higher taxes or who fight school budgets or who fight against any economic cost which is involved in rebuilding our cities and desegregating our society. I think that the Jewish community in the United States generally is committed towards these good goals. I rather think that the copping out occurs for different reasons, many of which we've just mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I agree that when it comes to supporting any sort of social legislation, the Jewish community as a whole has been certainly more liberal and more willing to give the financial support to, shall we say, aid to cities or more higher taxation for better schools. But I think when the problem, again, as it begins to strike closer to home, where perhaps some sacrifice is required, the Jewish response, if there is such a thing that we can categorize as a Jewish response, is really, I think, indistinguishable from the response of the white community as a whole. Namely, there is, I think, a great reluctance to go that extra mile, so to speak, to really put oneself in the forefront, to risk something, whether it's money, whether it's status within the community, whether it's friendships. These sacrifices, I think, are really not being made to the extent that they should be. And this, of course, I think, pertains to the white community as a whole, not only to the Jewish community.
None of the white community, Jewish, Catholic, or Protestant, is doing all that it should. But again, let me emphasize one thing, and that is that within the Jewish community, I don't think a person who is willing to go the last mile towards a better society and towards a society of equal justice for black and white suffers any kind of social loss. I really don't think so. As a matter of fact, I would say that it's almost a course, it can almost be said to be a course which is risk-free in terms of one's standing in the Jewish community, to be willing to go as far as your conscience will let you. Now, that isn't to say that most Jews are willing to go that far, but I don't think the community looks down upon one who is willing to be completely fair and to carry out the prophetic tradition.
Well,
Mr. Sider, thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. This is NICALL in New York, and we'll be returning with more calls from listeners across the nation with our guest tonight, Mr. Morris Abram, right after station identification. Stay tuned for the NICALL Network.
More NICALL with Del Shields and guest Morris Abram after station identification. Listen to the voices of NICALL.
We're trying to bring about change in this nation through nonviolent channels. Now, if we cannot do it through nonviolence, there are other forces that are going to lead people down a violent path, and the nation will be destroyed.
Ralph Abernathy on apathy and violence. And a white industrialist says jobs will save us from a racial inferno.
It's better to learn and earn than to burn, baby, burn. Now, these are the changes in attitude that spring from the community as a whole to try to work with these people, not just work on them, and to have industry reach into the area and try to recruit and hire the guy that's qualified and to get the other fellow to take training so he, too, can get a job.
Speak for yourself on NICALL. Speak for yourself. Collect on NICALL. Area code 212-749-3311 or 866-5010 to Morris Abram about American violence and black anti-Semitism. Again, Del Shields.
And once again, a welcome to the various NICALL stations who join us for the second half hour. Our guest once again, Mr. Morris Abram, who is calling in from New York. And tonight we are discussing the American violence and black anti-Semitism. Mr. Abram, I'd like to pose this question to you. Dr. Judd L. Teller, who I understand is an authority on the Jewish community, he has recommended that funds be used for the removal and relocation of tens of thousands of Jewish businesses, most of them generally called mama and papa stores. And feeling that perhaps the relocation of these businesses might in some way help to create a much better dialogue in the black community, because possibly these stores or these businesses would then be turned over, not given, but turned over, or either sold to black merchants. What is your feeling about this?
Well, I think to the extent that you can get more black merchants operating in black communities, communities better off, and for a variety of reasons. Number one, I think there's a certain pride that goes with ownership. Second, I think the development of the middle class, which comes from the entrepreneur, is a very desirable thing for the Negro community. It's part of the upward bound movement in our economic ladder. And another thing is that I suppose that it gives a better economic base for the Negro community, which, let's face it, is quite deprived. But I would deplore any suggestion that Jews should be gotten out of the ghetto because it isn't safe for them to be there. I just don't feel there is that kind of problem. You know, the surveys that have been taken, Mr. Shields, and by reliable institutions, demonstrate that there's less anti-Semitism amongst blacks than amongst whites in this country. So I don't think there should be any panic about it, but there certainly should be a general long-term movement towards development of an entrepreneurial, store-owning, and service-giving establishments in the Negro community.
Can we talk for just a moment about attitudes? Among black people, there has always been a feeling that the Jewish people are very liberal people. Very liberal in their attitudes towards black. Many Jews have often said, I understand your problem, I sympathize with your problem because I too am a minority. And there are blacks who are now beginning to resent this. They don't feel that there is really a compatibility with the two races in this particular area. What is your feeling about this?
Well, look, I can't deny the fact that the Jew has long said that he had a compassion for other people in trouble because he had had so much of it for so long. And that's a perfectly natural thing for the Jew to say. And yet, I can understand how a Negro facing the rather desperate plight that so many of them do in this country can feel that, that they'd rather have more action than less and less sympathy. So I can understand both sides of this dialogue. However, if you ask me what Jews could do, I think they could do less verbalizing and more take more direct steps towards the alleviation of the plight of, I would say, 5 or 6 million people who are black in this country and who really are below the poverty line and suffer all kinds of deprivations. Perhaps the best thing we can do is mobilize ourselves as active citizens, try to get this Congress to make a commitment to ending racism, poverty, and discrimination in this country. Congress certainly hasn't made up its mind to do it. I think the president has, and I think the courts have, but this Congress is committed to the elimination of hoof and mouth disease amongst cattle, but it sure isn't committed to the alleviation of discrimination between peoples.
One last question just before we accept more calls. We've got calls standing by from Miami, Florida, and Atlanta, Georgia, as well as New York. Another popular and not necessarily accepted theory, but a popular theory of, among many blacks, is the fact that many who have worked for black have worked for Jewish merchants, whether it was as an errand boy or a stock boy or in some capacity in the community or in their stores, they have often said, well, I have worked for Jews, but Jews never really taught me anything, or they never taught me the business. Is there an obligation on the part of a Jewish merchant who employs a black in his store to actually teach the business, or is it just his obligation to see that he gets a good day's work done?
Well, I don't know whether there's no legal obligation, that's for sure. But I should think there's a moral obligation, of course. But, you know, speaking of the relationship of the Negro population to the Jewish merchant or the Jewish landlord or whatnot, I don't know whether you've seen it, but Harp and Row published not very long ago a book called Protest and Prejudice, which is a study of beliefs in the black community with a foreword by Rustin and various public opinion polls done by the University of California. Now, they show rather decisively, that is this book and these polls, that you find just as many Negroes who say they've had a good experience with white merchants and white employers as those who say they've had a bad experience. And it all depends upon what was the nature of the individual who was the employer or the shopkeeper, and what was the nature of the customer or the person who was the worker. You've got both good and bad, I'm sure, in the Negro community and in the Jewish community.
Mr. Abram, we'll begin accepting some more calls, this time from Atlanta, Georgia. Mr. Lonsdale is hearing Night Call over WAOK. Your question, Mr. Lonsdale.
I once faced the Jewish movement, if you don't mind. I was talking to a black militant today in town, and he said that the nonviolent movement died with Martin King, Dr. Martin L. King. What do you think of that?
I don't think it did, and I hope it didn't, because, look, this country is in bad shape. And I don't think that the country works well, that is, the political system works well, unless the people are confronted with the bad things in our society. And I think the nonviolent movement is a way that we were able to hold the mirror up to our society to see its problems, but without smashing the mirror.
But who's taking the lead here now?
Well, I would say that the whole Southern Christian Leadership Conference still believes in nonviolence. I would say that every national leader with a very large Negro following, I would say, believes in nonviolence.
Well, tell me, what happened to Resurrection City?
What happened to it?
Yes. Well, in terms of it, it had to leave Washington as far as its settlement, of course. But what stand would you say it's going to take now?
Well, I don't think it was a total success, but on the other hand, I think there are reasons why it wasn't a total success. I think the objects of those who planned Resurrection City were a little too vague. You know, you can't just carry on a nonviolent demonstration for general improvement. I think you have specific goals which can be attained in a short run. But I don't think you can expect a nonviolent demonstration like Resurrection City to cure 150 or 200 years of faults in the United States.
I see. Now, I have one other question, and then I'll be through. Now to your black militants. Would you say that they are playing two roles?
What do you mean by that?
Well, one role of a militant and another role of a militant as somewhat of an identity.
Oh, yeah, sure. Look, if you're speaking of, let's take black power, which is the cry of the militant, I think it has two meanings. If black power means, hey, look, I want some pride, I want some self-respect, I want some identity, I want some ethnic integrity, I want also some economic and political power, which I can use as a group like other people have used to climb to the to a better level in American life. Look, that's fine. I think that's great. If, in other words, black power is used in black separatism in order to regroup, in order to enter the mainstream of American life towards the goal of integration, I think that's entirely acceptable. Now, what bothers me about this cry, as it's crudely and ambiguously used, is that it sometimes is a cry of those who want to take violent means. And in that regard, I don't think it creates pride, and I don't think it does any good. I think it is counterproductive. I think it can create counterviolence. It can create black reaction in the Congress. And I think it can stifle the progress of the Negro towards American goals. But I applaud militancy in seeking one's identity and in fighting by nonviolent legal means for justified goals.
Mr. Lonsdale?
Yeah.
You asked a question earlier about what happened to Resurrection City. You're from Atlanta.
Yeah.
And the headquarters of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference is in Atlanta.
Well, no, I'm here visiting. I'm from Chattanooga.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I see.
I was, well, while you're in Atlanta, why not check in with the Southern Christian Leadership headquarters?
I will.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you for calling,
sir. For the questions you answered for me.
Thank you.
Yes, bye now.
This is Night Call in New York, American Violence and Black Anti-Semitism is our discussion tonight, and our guest is Mr. Morris Abram. Our next call is from Miami, Florida. Mr. Richardson is hearing Night Call over WFLA. Your question, Mr. Richardson.
Yes, I'd like to ask a question.
Yes, sir.
What makes people the feeling that a Jew cannot be a president of the United States?
Well, I don't have that feeling myself.
Why is it that they never have been able to succeed or success in making
the
White House?
I think it's a very good question. This country has had a tradition, it's an unworthy tradition, of anti-Catholicism, anti-black, anti-Jew, and at times it's been anti-Italian, anti-Irish. The country has been put together out of a sort of a crazy quilt pattern of diverse religious and ethnic groups. Now, it's taken us a long time to learn to live with each other, and those who are in a majority have generally held political power until those who had a minority status got some economic power, got some education, and then began to move as a political group and into the mainstream of American life. Now, the Jew, I think, like the Catholic, which finally overcame this so-called bar to the highest public office, I think that you will overcome that bar, and I'm going to make a prediction to you, too. Mm-hmm. I suspect that my son will live to see the day, though I may not, that a Negro will be the president of the United States, and you may even see a Negro who's a woman.
Yeah,
President of the United States. There's another discrimination in our public life. No woman has ever been a president.
Yeah, well, I realize this, but I'm still trying to define one answer here, and that is, here we have the Wallace campaign, and we have the Negro campaigning, and then we have the anti-white campaigning, and I'm keep saying, what makes these different? Is that they feel like the Negroes are so different. I mean, still and yet, they're doing the same exact thing, but still they are trying to do in a different form. In other words, if Wallace feel like he's right, the Negro feel like he's right. And what makes them look at the Negro with a dumb would look and make him look at the white man with a different eye?
Well, you asking me why people are prejudiced against the blacks? Is that your question?
Yeah, why?
Well, I think there are no good reasons, but I can give you what I think are some of the background of the problem. First thing is that the Negro came to this country as a slave, mm-hmm. and people historically have looked down upon people who are slaves. Now, there was no fault of the Negro that he was a slave.
Mr. Abram, I'm sorry, I must interrupt, sir, but we have to depart for station identification,
right.
Or we'll be coming right back. Mr. Richardson, thank you for calling, and Mr. Abram will continue your answer right after station identification. Thank you, sir. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Morris Abram after station identification. Call it a social pressure valve, the voice of the ghetto, the voice of disgust, the voice of hope. Call it what you will, it's the voice of the people. Night Call lets people talk, and experts on the phone anywhere in the country or world offer answers to some of the problems. Having a heart-to-heart squawk, at least it gets people talking, first about their problems and eventually to each other. Night Call has a potential cast of 200 million Americans, and we now cover 50 stations in 40 cities. It could just be the most important listening post on the air today because it starts people talking. A program you should listen to. A forum to speak for yourself. If we don't start talking to each other, we'll end up shouting, and there's no telling where we'll wind up after that. Night Call, every weeknight on this station.
Speak for yourself. Collect on Night Call. Area code 212-749-3311 or 866-5010 to Morris Abram about American violence and black anti-Semitism. Again, Del Shields.
Mr. Abram, I'm sorry I had to interrupt your answer, but if you want to continue.
No, I was merely trying to say that the Negro came to the United States in chains as a slave. We have a status-conscious society. That because of the deprivation of slavery and its aftermath, the lack of education, the lack of economic opportunity, the Negro had a poor status, and I think that was the beginning of the trouble, plus the fact he was clearly identifiable by color. I hope we can get over it.
Do you view the problem in America today as a white problem or a black problem?
No question about what it is. It's a white problem. It's a problem of perception, and any problem of perception is in the eyes of the beholder.
Our next caller is coming in from Manchester, Connecticut, hearing Night Call over WFCR-FM, Mr. Baratano. Your question, sir.
Mr. Abrams, this accusation that people are making against the Jews on the Negro question reminds me of what has happened in Germany and also general prejudice against the Jews, and that is that the general impression is that they control a lot of the business, and they're the landlords and the businessmen of the area. And,
right.
And I wondered if this were statistically true. And of course, I feel that if this is so, it's only because that the Jew is ambitious, works hard, and gets there, and other people do not.
Well, you know, you've asked a very good question, and one that I'm sure is in the minds of thousands of people listening to us tonight.
Now, I thought this was a general
it's a good question.
Impression, and I wondered, I'd like to clear in my own mind.
Let me give you some facts and figures, which I happen to know about because the American Jewish Committee has done a lot of surveying in this field. You know, a few years ago, we did a survey of the major public utilities of the United States, and there were practically no Jews, practically none, in top managerial position. 2 years ago, we did a study of the major banks of the United States, the commercial banks, the 50 largest. Now, Jews are supposed to be bankers. And we found that there were there were 45 banks in the United States that didn't have a single top Jewish officer out of the 50. Now, if you look at the automobile industry, which is our largest industry, there are no Jews prominent in the automobile industry. If you look at the steel industry, which is one of the great industries of the country, there are very few Jews involved in steel. If you look at coal and basic mineral resources, practically no Jews involved. It is true that most Jews have, by virtue of education, because that's the road toward success, most Jews do live middle-class lives. But in terms of control of great wealth, it is a fact that the banks, the public utilities, the basic industries of the country not only do not have many Jews in positions of high authority, but have practically none.
Thank you for calling, sir.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Mr. Weston is hearing Night Call over WOSU-FM in Columbus, Ohio. Your question, Mr. Weston.
Mr. Abram?
Yes, sir.
Good morning. I was wondering...
Good morning. I thought it was still night.
Well, over here, it's just about morning. I was wondering, do you feel that man needs a scapegoat, that there has to be someone that is at fault for all the ills? If it weren't for the communists, would it be the Jews and Governor Wallace's speeches, or would it be the Negroes in a less veiled manner? Is it there always a need for someone to be the scapegoat, as in the biblical term?
Well, I hope that's not true, but politicians seem to think so, and a good many have gotten elected on that proposition, haven't they? But obviously, there may be some anthropological truth in the proposition that you state, that maybe man does need a scapegoat. He's had it from biblical times on. And it is a fact, it is just a fact, that there has been a classical scapegoat of all history. And that happens to be the religious group of which I'm a member. It's a terrible commentary. And in our country today, I'm bound to say that the Negro is much more often the scapegoat than any other identifiable group.
All right, thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
Dick Gregory raised the question last night. He foresees that within the next, 18 months, that we might see another kind of revolution, and this would be the revolution of the poor whites rising up against the power establishment or the members of the establishment, because as the blacks continue to break through and get more opportunity, and we introduce more black history, that the poor whites are saying, or will be saying at that time, that what you've been telling me just isn't true. Now, do you agree with this thinking, that there's a possibility of some kind of catalytic action setting off the poor whites across America?
Well, it's quite possible, you know. Let's face it, activism is a contagious thing. I can recall, and you do too, Mr. Shields, I suppose, when the first Negro sit-ins occurred in Greensboro, North Carolina, in 1960. I thought it would be a sporadic thing. It would be over by next week. Never occurred to me that it would blossom into a great nonviolent movement which shook the country up. I'm positive that... These demonstrations probably serve to focus attention on the power of demonstrations to the point that those who had the Vietnam cause in their hearts began to use similar techniques. And I think that America does respond in a way which is hopeful to nonviolent, peaceful demonstrations. And I think as long as the demonstrations are lawful and peaceful, they can be massive and impressive and can get results. The thing that bothers me is violence, which has occurred in some of our cities, some of it crowd violence in the form of, we are told, social protest. such as occurred in Detroit and Newark and in Cleveland last week. I don't think this is productive, and I would think if it's imitated, it would be a very bad thing, because I think it's going to give rise to a reaction by people whose motives are not good, and in my judgment, people who are disposed to use violence are more frequently bad than good, and if we're going to settle our questions by violence, I don't think the good people are going to win.
Well, the same manner in which the Black Power movement has given birth to many leaders, is it possible that among the poor whites that there could be some kind of mobilization where new leaders would come to the helm? And if so, where would they direct their violence? Would they direct it towards the blacks, or would they direct it towards the affluential whites?
I don't know. It's a good question, but I've never thought of it. I would assume that there are good leaders amongst the white poor as well as amongst the black poor. I'm sure there's good natural leadership.
Let's take another call, Mr. Abram, this time from Omaha, Nebraska. Mrs. Beeson is hearing Night Call over KBON. Your question, Mrs. Beeson.
Yes, I would like to address Mr. Abrams. I can appreciate his documentation of figures of the various high levels of employment of Jewish people. But as a member of the ghetto, I ask him, who is the biggest loan merchant in the ghetto areas, the so-called ghetto areas, your meat market, your used clothing salesman, as well as your used furniture salesman, the variety type store,
yeah,
or your grocery store. I would like to ask me, these are the people that many of us steal for years, whether knowingly in kindness to you, knowingly or unknowingly, have thwarted us and exploited us. Who was pressuring them, we cannot say. But these people, we have been mercilessly at their mercy, because their prices were sold, their products were sold because of the proximity of the area they were purchased, and their prices were not commensurate with goods were delivered. So if he could tell me, who then could we blame in the ghetto area as being the principal one having taken our money out of the area and to live in suburbia?
Mrs. Beeson, I'm going to thank you for calling, and Mr. Abram has about 30 seconds to answer. Thank you so much.
Well, I think you blame the system that created the ghetto in the first place, that created the necessity of people buying in one place rather than buying competitively from many choice stores. The problem is the ghetto itself. The problem is the problem of the total society, which is the ghetto, which I think implicitly is discriminatory, and I don't think that there can be a very good life in a situation in which so many our people...
Mr. Abram, thank you so much for being our guest tonight on Night Call. Good night and peace.
Night Call, the new nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tomorrow night, same time, same station, veteran Vietnamese civilian worker Don Luce and why he says we're bungling the job in Vietnam. Listen tomorrow night, discuss freely and responsibly your own personal opinions. Speak for yourself on Night Call. Produced by the United Methodist Church, presented with National Council of Churches, National Catholic Office for Radio and Television, American Jewish Committee, and Urban Coalition.